Home to Mother by Doris Pilkington Garimurra. Cover notes. Where do you girls come from?
We come from Jigalong, answered Gracie,
and we're running away to go home. When Gracie, Daisy and Molly are taken from their mothers and sent away to a camp at Moore River, thousands of miles from their home country, they decide to escape. But when the only way home is along a rabbit-proof fence, and you're being chased by the police, escaping is just the start of your adventure. This younger reader's version of Doris Pilkington's amazing true story of courage and love will grab readers of all ages and take them on a journey through a country as beautiful as it is harsh. A journey home. About the author. Doris Pilkington's traditional name is Garimurra. She was born in 1937 at Balfour Down Station in the East Pilbara, homeland of her Madu ancestors. As a toddler, she was removed by authorities from her home at the station, along with her mother, Molly Craig, and baby, Sister Anna, and committed to Moore River Native Settlement. This was the same institution Molly had escaped from 10 years previously, the account of which is told in Follow the Rabbit Proof Fence. At 18, Doris left the mission system as the first of its members to qualify for the Royal Perth Hospital's Nursing Aid Training Program. Following marriage and a family, she studied journalism and worked in film video production. Caprice, A Stockman's Daughter, originally published in 1991, is her first book and won the 1990 Uniapin Award. Her second book, Follow the Rabbit Proof Fence, was first published in 1996 and has been reprinted several times since international release of the film Rabbit Proof Fence in 2002. Doris has travelled extensively throughout the world with the film's director, Philip Noyce. In 2006, Doris was honoured as a member of the Order of Australia for her service to Indigenous literature. Home to Mother is her children's edition of Follow the Rabbit Proof Fence. The dedication reads, To Matthew French, the boy who gave me the idea for this book. List of Madu Jarrah words. Bukala, hurry. Bunna, ground or earth. Sand. Judu, older sister. Jinji, fat or dripping. Galyu, water. Gagara, east. Gayali, north. Mardu, indigenous people of the western desert area. Malbu, flesh-eating evil spirit. Mirga, food. Mandu, meat. Marandu, goanna. Mardu Wonga, words or language of the Mardu. Wungu, a shelter. Yue, agreement, yes. Chapter 1, Home. It was winter in the Western Desert region. For the families of the small Aboriginal community of Jigalong, it was the time to set out on their bush picnics. They would walk far into the bush with the azure sky above and their feet firmly on the red earth, covered in clumps of green grass and purple, white and mauve mulla-mulla flowers. There seemed to be no other sounds but the soft breeze blowing through the leaves and the calls of songbirds. But if you stood and listened carefully, you could hear laughter or the soft voices of the elders as they spoke to the children. They were teaching them how to hunt and collect bush foods. The children were learning bushcrafts and survival skills of their people, the Madu. The elders knew these skills would be passed on and would continue the Madu culture. Molly and her cousin Gracie had these skills. They could join the women in the search for bush fruit and vegetables and digging for goannas, honey ants, and lonkies, known also as bardies, a tasty grub found in the roots of the acacia trees. They used the digging stick as their main tool. If it was needed for protection, the same stick, or wana, was used as a weapon. Boys used boomerangs and spears when hunting emus, kangaroos, and wild turkeys. Nobody owned guns. The women found a suitable place to make a big fire to cook the fresh meat in the hot coals. Half would be eaten and the rest taken back home to those who were unable to leave the camp. Everyone was headed back to camp when they spotted strange movements near the camels that carried supplies for the local camel driver. Molly and Gracie ran ahead to see what it was. As they neared the camel yard, they spotted their cousins Amy, Dolly and Joni filling their pannikins with milk from the mother camels. Molly and Gracie joined in and hid among the thick acacia bushes, sipping the still warm milk. The five girls returned to camp very tired but happy. During a supper of hot damper, warm sweet tea and roast kangaroo, Molly and Gracie shared stories of their day collecting food in the bush. They wished that their cousin Daisy could have been with them too.
They were always together. Daisy and Gracie were called Mudda Mudda because, like Molly, their skin was not as dark as the other Madu children. Their mothers were Molly's aunts. Their fathers were white stockmen. Molly and Gracie helped collect more firewood for the night, then settled down to sleep near the blazing fire. It had been a perfect day. After a good night's rest, Molly and Gracie walked further up the river to bathe and to wash their clothes. They returned to the camp clean and refreshed in time for a lunch of tinned corned beef, fresh damper, and warm, sweet, milky tea. Just as the family finished their meal, the camp dogs began barking loudly, upsetting the calm of the peaceful riverbed camp.
"Quiet! Come here!"
Old Granny Maidy ordered the skinny camp dogs. Once the crying babies and frightened toddlers were settled, everyone looked in the direction of what caused the alarm. There, on the high riverbank, stood a white man in khaki clothing. Addressing no one in particular, the man uttered those fateful words.
"I've come to take Molly, Gracie and Daisy, the three half-caste girls, with me to send them to school down south."
The man's name was Constable Riggs. He was a protection officer and also a policeman with orders to search for children of Aboriginal mothers and white fathers. The Department of Native Affairs called these children the half-castes and were rounding them up from all over Western Australia's East Pilbara region. The girls had no choice but to obey and go with him. It was the law. With tears streaming down their faces, Molly and Gracie climbed up on the constable's big bay horse.
"Where is Daisy?"
the constable asked.
"She's with her mother at Murrumunda."
"Well then, we'd better go there and find her," said Constable Riggs,
and they rode away in the direction of Murrumunda Station. Behind them, the mother's high-pitched wails filled the air, followed by cries and sobbing of the families. Molly and Gracie looked back just once before the camp disappeared through the river gums. It wasn't long before Daisy was caught and joined her cousins on their long and terrifying journey south. It was the first time ever for Molly, Daisy and Gracie to travel any other way than by horse and cart. Under police guard, and over several weeks, the three girls were transported by train and ship and finally by car to their final destination, the Moore River Native Settlement. It was dark, wet and cold when the girls arrived. They were marched across the slippery, muddy entrance to a large shed-like building, the girls' dormitory. Here, they were each shown to a bed covered with only a thin blanket. As soon as Nurse Evans left the dormitory, the three Jigalong girls rushed to find each other and laid huddled in one bed. Chapter 2. The Escape. Molly lay quietly listening to the girls' soft snoring against the background of rain falling on the tin roof. Everything was strange. There were no girls here from their home country, the Western Desert. She looked around the large room. It was crowded with beds without sheets, and for a toilet, there was a bucket. In the early light, she could see metal bars across the windows. Outside, the jangling noise of keys and the scrape of a padlock left no question. Molly, Gracie and Daisy were no longer free and happy. They were in a jail.
"I'm not staying here," Molly promised herself.
The door swung open. It was the nurse who had met the car when they arrived. She bustled around the dormitory, calling out orders.
"Wakey, wakey! Rise and shine, quickly now. There's the bell for breakfast."
Daisy and Gracie followed Molly out onto the veranda. They stood beside her as she peeped through the latticework. Molly smiled to herself at the sight of the heavy rain, enough to wash away any sign of tracks.
"Come on, you girls. The bell's rung. It's time for breakfast."
Martha Jones led the new girls to the dining room. There were boys, too. They stood in a separate queue. The three Jigalong girls took their food and sat together to eat the weevily porridge and bread dipped in fat. Between sips of weak tea, Molly whispered in Mardu Wonga, the language of home. She told Gracie to save all her bread crusts, hide them away.
"Shh," Martha hissed. "Not allowed to speak blackfella talk. We gotta speak English all the time."
Martha nodded in the direction of a tall Aboriginal man and said,
"There's the tracker. He catches the runaways."
His name was Moodoo, she told them. He followed runaways by reading their tracks, and even many days after they escaped could find them. Every boy and girl feared him.
"Lots tried to run away back home, but he caught them every time and brought them back here." "I don't like this place," Molly watched the tracker, "where they lock you up at night and let you out in the morning." "This is not a bad place once you get used to things," Martha said.
But Gracie and Daisy's eyes were on Molly. Molly sat back, observing everything taking place around her.
Martha talked to Gracie and Daisy about school at the settlement. The Jigalong girls frowned. Molly had to act quickly. School was the next day, and they would be separated for the first time since they had left home. Molly began plotting their escape. The next morning, the three Western Desert girls sat on their beds watching the other girls getting ready for school. They were already dressed.
"Come on, you girls. The school bell's gone," said Martha.
"You don't want to be late on your first day."
"Don't wait for us," Molly said. "We know where the school is. We'll follow. We have to empty the toilet bucket first."
As soon as everyone left, Molly told Gracie and Daisy, "We're not going to school. We're going to run way back home."
"To Jigalong?"
Gracie exclaimed.
"Yes," answered Molly. "So get your things together."
Gracie and Daisy looked at her with confused faces.
"We're going all the way to Jigalong?"
asked Gracie once again.
"It's a long way, Juru."
Daisy sounded nervous.
"And we might get lost."
"I know it's a long way," agreed her big sister. "But it's going to be easy, you'll see.
We just find the rabbit-proof fence and follow it all the way home."
"So come on, let's go," she said firmly. They quickly grabbed their calico bags and a few personal items. Molly ordered Gracie to help her carry the toilet bucket. They hurried through the wet yard, trying hard not to spill the contents of the bucket on themselves. Standing the empty bucket outside the lavatory, Molly checked that there was no one around, then motioned for Gracie and Daisy to follow.
"Buckle up! Buckle up!
Hurry, hurry." With that order, Molly, Gracie and Daisy took their first steps on what would prove to be the longest walk by three young girls in the history of this country. Gracie and Daisy followed Molly, running fast as they could over the wet sand, speeding down the track along the cliffs that overlooked the brown, foaming river below. The slope was steep, and the narrow path was covered with loose stones that slowed them down. They held onto the spiky shrubs to steady their descent. On they went, until finally they were safely at the bottom of the cliff. The girls reached the slippery bank and stared into the river's swirling currents. Molly spoke above the noise of the rushing water. "We need to find a place to cross to the other side." Daisy and Gracie didn't think much of their chances, but Molly was confident that they could find a way. The day before, she had watched the settlement girls using a long stick to test the depth of the river, and she was certain that she could do the same thing. She found a stick and tested a few places along the riverbank, but each seemed too risky and dangerous. They started running again along the muddy banks, pushing past the young trees in their path. Some distance along the track, Molly spotted what she knew was the perfect place to cross the flooded river.
"We're going to cross here," Molly said as she climbed onto a large gum that had been uprooted during the recent storms.
It made a natural bridge. Gracie and Daisy stood back, shaking their heads.
"Come on, don't be frightened," Molly said. "Just follow me,"
and slid her feet carefully, one after the other, along the fallen tree trunk. She reached the other side and turned to see Gracie lifting Daisy up onto the tree. The little girl stepped cautiously along the trunk with Gracie doing the same, following close. At the other end, Molly stretched out her arms, ready to catch both girls if necessary. Daisy moved slowly, too scared to breathe, until she could feel Molly's strong grasp. When she felt Gracie cuddled against her, Daisy knew they were safe. They had reached the other side. They were on the other side of the river and feeling relieved, but Molly knew that they were not out of danger from being caught by the tracker Moodoo. If he found them, she thought to herself, he would bring them back. Molly pushed them on through the heavy mud following along the river. They sloshed for a couple of hours through the flooded river flats, then sat and rested on thick reeds beside a large gum tree. After a while, Molly ordered Gracie and Daisy to get up, saying,
"Buckle up, buckle up, enough rest. We go gaily,
north,
now,
all the way.
How do you know it's the right way to go? There's no sun. The sky is full of clouds."
Gracie remained seated. Molly didn't answer. She didn't tell them that she had caught a brief glimpse of the sun when it appeared behind the rain clouds in the western sky, and that was all she needed to tell her she was going the right way. She began walking. The other two followed. They struggled to move faster as thick mud stuck to their sand shoes. Once again they were ducking under low branches and pushing aside the paperbark saplings, making a pathway for themselves. Above in the leafy canopy of the river gums, startled birds fluttered from their nests in alarm. They no longer heard the slush-slush sound made when they trampled over the water-soaked reeds. The girls were glad to leave the river behind. They were able to move faster over the wet grass that wiped the river-flat mud from their sand shoes. They reached the huge marigums, where the ground was covered with decayed gum nuts. They could not walk without wobbling and slipping on the fallen gum nuts. Molly guided Gracie and Daisy out into an area full of trees and bushes. Scattered amongst them were grevillea thickets with prickly branches that scratch bare legs. The girls paused under the banksias to admire this beautiful bushland. They knelt on the white sand to take a closer look at the unusual wild flower known as the kangaroo paw. They were fascinated by the long stems with velvety red and green flowers and the smaller yellow and red ones. They jumped up when suddenly a shower of rain fell. Looking towards the sky, Molly saw it was only scattered clouds bringing light showers. The rain cooled the sting of their scratched legs. The showers passed over, heading inland away from them. Molly was thankful. The rain would wash away their footprints. Walking in front, Molly didn't notice the other two looking back to check now and again, just in case. At 14, Molly was the eldest, and tradition meant she was entrusted with the safety of her sister and cousin. Wherever she went, they would be beside or behind her, always. Molly's bushcraft knowledge was matched by her determination to lead them safely through this strange country and home to Jigalong. Molly stepped out heavily on the sand, eyes forward, taking in the landscape and whatever lay before them. Their first day on the run had been a long one. They had covered many miles, and Molly decided they could afford to sit down to eat their bread crusts, washed down with fresh water from the pools nearby. As they rested, the girls admired the bright orange and white, cone-shaped banksia flowers. Chapter 3. The Malbu. Gracie and Daisy were walking along, chattering to each other, when Molly alerted them to something ahead. They were almost past a stand of banksia trees when Molly ordered the girls to stand still and listen. She could hear someone or something coming towards them. She whispered for them to hide. Quickly! They dived headfirst into the thick bushes and slid in deeper on their stomachs. They kept very still, waiting for whatever it was to appear. The footsteps came closer. The ground shook. The girls could feel every step. Their hearts were thumping. Numb with fear, they could do nothing but stare as what looked like a giant, hairy man came into view. In an instant, it had passed their hideaway, and the sound of footsteps became fainter and fainter, then disappeared altogether. Too scared to move, the girls lay speechless, until a flash of lightning made them jump. In the distance was the deep rumble of thunder. Long moments passed before the heavy footfalls could no longer be heard. The girls crawled out of their hideaway. "That was a marbu, all right," Molly announced. "A proper one, too," she added. The thing, whatever it was, fitted the description of a marbu, the sharp-toothed, flesh-eating evil spirit that has been described in stories from the remote desert country since creation time. Even if the so-called evil spirit being was really just a big hairy man, his face reminded these young girls from the desert of the stories of the Malbu. The old people were always warning young ones to be careful when walking in the bush. To Molly, Gracie and Daisy, what they saw was a Malbu. No one could convince the terrified girls that it wasn't. "Bakala, bakala," ordered Molly. The determined leader was back in control. The frightened teenager was gone. Chapter 4. The First Night on the Run. "We must get away from this place," Molly didn't need to add. "There might be more of those things around. It will be dark soon. We have to find a safe, warm place to sleep." Molly's sharp eyes scanned the banksia trees and beyond until she spied a range of sand dunes. "We go over there now." She pointed to the dunes, the fear in her voice gone. When they reached the dunes, Molly showed them the rabbit burrows all around, and said together they would dig one big enough to fit the three of them snugly for the night.
"We're going to sleep in the bunna, ground, like a rabbit, Judo," Daisy asked.
"Your way." "Yes, that's right. Nobody will find us in there." No one would expect to find three runaways sleeping in a rabbit burrow, Molly laughed. "Come on, you two, help me," Molly ordered in her usual manner. On their hands and knees, shoulders touching, the girls dug a burrow big enough for the three of them to squeeze into. Before they crawled into the burrow for the night, they sat silently and ate the dry bread crusts. This was their first night out in the bush since leaving their home at Jigalong almost 9 weeks ago. Molly, Gracie and Daisy, 14, 12 and 9, were now runaways, sleeping in a rabbit burrow, searching for the rabbit-proof fence, which would take them all the way back home. Those were the thoughts on her mind as Molly drifted off to sleep. She was awakened suddenly by frightened cries. It was Gracie calling out,
"Judo, Judo, where are you?"
"I'm here, right next to you. What's the matter?"
answered Molly softly. Gracie told her she had dreamed the Marlboro. He had discovered their hideout and had tried to pull her out by her long black hair. Their excited talking woke Daisy, and she began to cry. Molly spoke softly, saying not to worry. She would protect them always. Before they fell asleep, huddled tight, Molly checked the night sky. Chapter 5. No rabbit for breakfast. The next morning, very early, the three girls were awakened by a thump, thump, thumping all around them. As they looked out, they saw rabbits chasing about their burrows as they did every morning.
"Let's catch one to eat," Gracie suggested.
"It's not worth trying to catch one this time," replied the eldest.
"Why can't we try to catch one, Juru?"
moaned Gracie and Daisy.
Gracie added, "I'm hungry for mandu."
Meat. The willful Gracie refused to listen to Molly, which was nothing unusual. They would argue over anything. Daisy said nothing. She was used to their bickering and squabbling. Gracie spied a rabbit nearby and gave chase, caught it and killed it.
"Oh, what did you do that for?" snapped Molly.
"I'm hungry, that's why," answered Gracie in the same tone.
"We got no matches to make a fire to cook it,"
Molly reminded her cousin, getting angry with her now. Molly and Daisy looked on in astonishment as Gracie held the dead rabbit up to her mouth and bit into its raw flesh. She swore loudly in Mardu Wonga, flung the rabbit down and stomped off over the prickly ground cover to the bottom of the dunes. Molly and Daisy chased after her.
"We should have stayed at the settlement," Gracie pouted.
"No. If we're caught, they will shave our heads, give us a good flogging, then lock us up in the boob with only water and bread to eat."
Molly's voice was harsh.
"You want to go back to that?"
The other two stood silently as Molly continued.
"We came down together, and we will go home together. Don't worry. We will find something to eat, you'll see."
Molly put her arm around Gracie.
"This country's different from ours, so we got to learn to find their bush tucker, that's all."
The girls were missing their mothers and wishing they were back home. A week later, an item appeared in the West Australian newspaper reporting on the three Aboriginal girls who had run away from the Moore River native settlement. It ended with a message from Mr. A. O. Neville, the Chief Protector of Aborigines. "We have been searching high and low for the children for the past week. The only trace we found of them was a dead rabbit which they had been trying to eat. We are very anxious that no harm may come to them in the bush." The runaways agreed to a plan of walking at sunrise and resting at sunset. There was a cold wind blowing across the countryside as they walked steadily through the strange sandplain country. They walked northwards until they came to another river. But this time, there was no log to cross on. Sharp-eyed Molly scanned the bank carefully and then announced, "We will cross over by walking along the fence."
Gracie and Daisy looked confused.
"Come on. Watch me, I'll show you how."
Molly tucked her shift into the elastic of her bloomers, then slung the calico bag with her precious belongings, a mirror, comb, and spare set of clothes, around her neck. She placed her feet firmly on the bottom stretch of wire and grabbed the top length and gripped it firmly.
"See? It's strong enough to hold us."
Moving along slowly, she called back, "Don't look down, and you'll be all right." Gracie and Daisy stepped onto the fence, not daring to look down at the churning brown water. They had to block out the frightening sound below. When they felt the cold water swirling against their sand shoes, they began to panic. It took all their courage and willpower to continue. How happy they were when they joined Molly on solid ground. Chapter 6. The Welcome Sight. The second day, they passed through a section of bushland that had been ravaged by fire. The Western Desert girls knew the recent rains would bring the burnt landscape back to life. Since the scary incident further back along the track, Molly, Gracie and Daisy walked in silence with more awareness than before. The silence was broken when they reached the top of the next hill.
"Look down there," said Molly, pointing to what must have been one of the most welcome sights for a long time.
There, at the bottom of the hill, appeared two hunters. They were coming towards them. One hunter carried his catch, a marlu, kangaroo, over his shoulders. The girls stood behind a thick bush, out of sight, but when they saw the hunters were mardu, their caution gave way to hunger. They could almost taste the cooked kangaroo and marandus, goannas. As the hunters approached, the girls stepped out in the open where they could be seen. The hunters wondered how such young girls came to be travelling on their own and with so little. They sat down in the shade to talk. The girls were pleased when they learnt the hunters came from Marble Bar.
"Where do you girls come from?"
"We come from Jigalong," answered Gracie. "And we're running away to go home."
"Well, you're a long way from Jigalong," the older man said.
"We know, but we're going to get there,"
Molly spoke up. And we're hungry for mandu. Daisy looked longingly at the kangaroo.
This country is different from ours, you know, so you gotta be careful, said the man with snowy hair and bushy beard of the same colour. They got a mardu policeman, a proper cheeky fella. He flog all girls and boys if they run away from that place, he warned.
Yes, we know about him. Molly didn't need reminding.
He's a good tracker, Molly said. But he can't catch us. The rain washed all our tracks away.
After a long silence, the snowy bearded hunter nodded.
Well, you are going north, the right way.
He took a marandu from his catch and handed it to the eldest Jiglong girl. The other man broke off the kangaroo tail and held it out to Gracie and Daisy. As the girls rose to go, the young hunter called out, Here, you're gonna need this, holding up a box of matches. Then he took out another matchbox and filled it with salt. The two hunters watched the girls until they disappeared on the horizon. The old man said,
That big one. She knows her way.
Molly wasn't taking any chances. The food from the hunters allowed them to eat on the run. The distance they had covered gave them a good lead on the tracker and any others who might be out searching for them. At dusk, Molly led Gracie and Daisy to a clump of bushes that would be ideal for building a wunku, shelter. The girls busily collected branches and stacked them around the outside, filling in all the gaps to keep out the cold wind. They dug a large hole in the ground close to the shelter. Then with long sticks they set about raking the dry leaves and heaping them into the hole. Once they were satisfied with their little camp, they took out the box of matches and lit a fire. The flames warmed their bodies as they huddled around the fire, eating their first proper supper, a feed of fresh malu and marandu. Molly decided to take the risk of heaping just a few more pieces of wood on the fire. The bright flames and the warmth of the fire reminded the girls of home and families back at Jigalong. As the fire died down, Molly, Gracie and Daisy crawled into the shelter where they slept safe and warm. Chapter 7. More Rabbits. The next morning the girls were awakened by the sound of birds chirping and fluttering everywhere in the trees. There was a cold wind blowing. Molly gazed up into the sky and saw scattered clouds like huge balls of fluffy cotton wool. Breakfast was light. They ate the remaining kangaroo tail and marandu and filled up with fresh rainwater. After they had eaten, the girls scattered the branches of the wunku far from the place where they had made camp. The spot where the fire was made was covered with wet sand. Molly was making sure that no one could tell the runaways had ever been there.
More rain coming, Molly observed. Mudu won't be able to find our tracks.
She motioned to Daisy and Gracie to walk faster. Molly knew they needed to be a long way further on before nightfall. The good thing about trekking through this country, Molly thought to herself, was that sand plains were easy to walk on. The girls moved quickly. But now Molly was facing another problem. By midday, Gracie was feeling the pangs of hunger. She had had enough of the hardship of being on the run and not having enough to eat. Angry and not looking where she was going, Gracie caught her foot in the dense ground cover. She fell with a thud and lay there moaning.
We're gonna die. We got nothing to eat.
We are all hungry, so stop your grumbling, said Molly angrily.
She pulled Gracie to her feet, saying, Hurry up. We gotta move on quickly. Gracie became sullen, refusing to talk. She just followed, as if she were sleepwalking. All of a sudden, Molly shouted excitedly, Look over there! She was pointing to some sand dunes to their right. The unexpected announcement shook Gracie out of her dark mood. She ran up and stood beside Molly and Daisy.
What is it, Juru?
She asked. Then Daisy and Gracie saw them too. Rabbit burrows everywhere in the sand dunes.
We're not going to sleep in the bunna ground again, Gracie whined.
No, replied Molly.
We're going to catch them to eat.
That cheered Gracie up straight away. Roast rabbit sounded good to her. They had been walking for a long time without anything to eat since breakfast.
First of all, we block all the burrows except one, all right? Said Molly.
Daisy and Gracie nodded and started covering all the burrows except the one in the middle. Now all they had to do was wait. Then after what seemed like ages, out the rabbits came. First one, then two, and four and more.
Now, whispered Molly.
All three girls leaped out from the bushes and chased after the rabbits. The fast runners, Gracie and Molly, grabbed one each while Daisy wasn't able to catch even one. But it didn't matter, there was enough to share. The sun was almost setting in the west when they found a safe place to make a camp. They found branches and bushes and made a wunku, the same as the night before. The older two gutted the rabbits using sharp-pointed green sticks, then cooked them in the hot embers of the fire. They shared one for supper and saved the other for breakfast. They crawled into their shelter as the rain splashed down. Molly fell asleep, comforted to know their tracks would be erased. Chapter 8. The Fighting Kangaroos. In the morning they were awakened by all sorts of different bird calls. The colourful birds of the southwest reminded the girls of the small zebra finches and sulphur-crested cockatoos of Jigalong, and how much they missed them. Memories of home were always in their hearts and minds.
"We got a long way to go, so don't mess around,"
Molly called to the girls, who would have liked to sleep in just a little longer. But their big sister was firm. They had many miles to go yet. She led them northwards over the sand hills and through the Banksia woodlands of acacia thickets and thick clumps of heath bushes. A good thing about this country, Molly thought to herself, was that there was no shortage of trees and scrub to hide in. The girls walked along the slope of a hill. Below were open green pastures, which made a stark contrast against fields of bright yellow dandelions. It was so beautiful, but so different from their homeland. Suddenly the peacefulness of the early morning was shattered, for there, in a clearing, were two of the biggest kangaroos the girls had ever seen. Gasping with fear, the girls crouched behind the thick scrub that formed a hedge around the clearing and peered through to watch as the giant black boomers stood on their hind legs, kicking and clawing each other.
"Look at them," whispered Molly. "They're standing up and fighting like men."
The girls from Jigalong had never seen anything like this before. Kangaroos were only hunted and killed for meat, but here in this country were two boomers bigger and cheekier than at home.
"I'm frightened, Juru," Gracie said.
"Me too. Let's go away from this place."
Daisy squeezed Molly's hand. Molly was scared too, but she knew that she had to overcome her fear. She had to face any danger along the journey. She must, because she was the eldest, and Gracie and Daisy were family. She kept a hold of Daisy's hand to calm her, and Gracie held the other, and without a sound they crawled along behind the hedge well past the clearing. Every now and then, as they moved along, Molly would push the bushes aside and make certain the kangaroos were still too busy fighting each other to notice them. Chapter 9. The Search Plane. They were able to relax once they climbed over the boundary fence. For a few minutes, the three of them sat on a log to catch their breath and renew their courage to go on. It was very quiet. In fact, it was so quiet that Molly was able to hear an unusual sound, one that alarmed her. She stood up quickly and pulled Daisy up from her seat on the log.
"Come on, buckle up, buckle up."
The younger girls, fresh from the fright of the fighting boomers, obeyed without question. They raced towards the first big tree.
"Climb up and hide here," Molly commanded, as she gave Gracie a boost, then lifted Daisy up to her and climbed up to join them.
The girls stretched out on the limbs of the tree and lay there, not daring to move. They just listened and silently waited. Gracie and Daisy had learnt to do exactly what their big cousin and sister ordered, knowing that she would do the right thing by them, even if they had no idea what they were hiding from this time. At last they heard it. It was the engine of a small search plane. They watched as the plane circled over their hideaway a few times, then seemed to give up and turn back in the direction it had come. It took Molly, Daisy, and Gracie a while before their nerves settled down and they could swing down from the tree. Like the fighting kangaroos, the plane was a new experience for the girls from the western desert, and enough for one morning. This time Molly didn't need to tell them to hurry up. They understood what they were meant to do and pushed along quickly. Chapter 10. The Farmhouse. The three young girls tramped on through the bush, each lost in their thoughts of the morning's encounters. No one noticed the change in the weather and the rain clouds gathering in the sky above. Before they knew it, rain was pouring down upon them. Their hair hung limp and wet, dripping water down their necks and making them cold and miserable. Even when the rain stopped, they continued to walk. They were too wet and uncomfortable to stop and rest. Nearing a homestead, they heard an unexpected and certainly a most welcome sound, a sound they had not heard for some time. It reminded them of home, and the longing for their mothers and the need for their mothers' love became stronger. Rain-soaked and weary, they stood just listening to the farmyard animals, the squeaky windmill, barking dogs, and the familiar sound of the farm generator. These sounds only made them sadder, as they had known them all through their lives while growing up on cattle stations. Sadness gave way to pangs of hunger, and Molly took control. "Ask the missus to give us some food," she ordered the other two. Gracie and Daisy did what she asked, without protest, while Molly hid behind a big marri tree outside the fence.
She was shivering and uncomfortable in her wet clothes, but Molly kept her eyes on the house. She didn't want to think about what would happen if Daisy and Gracie didn't come out. What would she do? Molly watched and hoped that she wouldn't have to make that decision. Peering from the safety of her hiding place, she kept her eyes on Daisy and Gracie as they passed through the gate to the farmhouse. There was a little girl playing on the veranda who looked at them as they stopped at the bottom of the steps.
"Mom," she called out. "There's two girls out here and they're soaking wet."
Her mother stepped out onto the veranda and stared at the pair with their hair dripping down their downcast faces. "Are you the runaways from the settlement?"
"Yes,"
both Gracie and Daisy replied. "Where's the other one?" she asked, her eyes scanning the paddock.
"She's out there waiting for us," Gracie pointed. "Over the other side of the fence," added Daisy.
"Go and tell her to come here," the woman told them. "She should come and get dried too." Gracie dashed back through the gate and returned, leading a very reluctant Molly up the steps. The girls sat wrapped in blankets near the warm stove as the woman named Mrs. Flanagan prepared them something to eat. Hungry, tired, and still shivering from the soaking rain, they sat and politely answered her questions about who they were and where they were going. Molly sat rigidly, and though thankful for the comforts of warmth and food, she kept her silence while her sister and cousin answered Mrs. Flanagan's questions. The farmer's wife knew her young Aboriginal guests were the escapees from the native settlement. The local police had been around to every farm and town in the district, asking residents to be on the lookout for three Western Desert girls. Before Molly could stop her, Gracie blurted out that they were going to find the rabbit-proof fence and follow it all the way to Jiglong. "Well, you know what? You're going the wrong way." She passed a plate of sandwiches to Gracie and said, "The rabbit-proof fence is not north." Molly felt Mrs. Flanagan's eyes rest on her as she continued. "You need to go east towards Woburn. If you keep going north, you will end up in Geraldton or Dongara." Lunch was like manna from heaven. Sandwiches made with freshly baked bread, cold mutton and tomato chutney. This was followed by fruitcake and a cup of sweet milky tea. The warm room and a full stomach made the girls feel sleepy. With a loud scraping of her chair, Molly stood up and the other two joined her. Mrs. Flanagan asked them to wait. She took out paper bags and filled one with tea leaves and one with sugar, flour and salt. In another, she placed half a leg of mutton and a chunk of fruitcake. She handed each of them a large empty fruit tin, saying, "Put these in your bags too. You will need them to boil water in to make tea." Then she told them to follow her to a large shed opposite the farmhouse where there was a storeroom. "Here, change into these dry clothes," she said, holding up some old army uniforms. "You'd better take these too." She pulled out some empty wheat sacks. "They will keep you dry. Use them like this." She demonstrated, making a cape by pushing one corner into the other. The little girl watched as her mother handed Daisy and Gracie military jackets. Then to Molly, who had remained standing at the open door, Mrs. Flanagan held out a heavy overcoat and said, "Take it, please." "Thank you," Molly replied. As she watched the girls disappear into the surrounding woodlands, Mrs. Flanagan wondered what she must do. These three wouldn't fare any better than the others who had tried to escape from that place. They all seemed to get caught. She worried too that these girls from the northwest couldn't survive in this unfamiliar country. Mrs. Flanagan made the decision to send a telegram to Mr. Neal, the superintendent at Moore River Settlement. Chapter 11. The Wheat Belt. The police were alerted and knew that the escapees were passing through the wheat fields northeast of Perth. There were several reports of them approaching farmhouses in the area. Food was never refused. Molly had decided not to go east just yet, but continue northwards a while and elude the searchers who were just as determined. When she was satisfied that they had walked far enough, Molly turned east and continued on the way home.
"What if the tracker is waiting for us near the rabbit-proof fence?" Gracie asked.
"They won't catch us because we're too far in front of them," answered Molly with a confident toss of her head. The girls were wearing their warm clothing from the farmer's wife. They were able to move faster in the drizzling rain. As evening came, they began to get weary, and Molly knew it was time to make camp. With her thoughts on the warm tea and the remains of roast mutton and fruitcake, the girls began setting up camp with renewed energy. They knew exactly what they must do. Soon, a cozy wunku was built, and the whole prepared for the fire. They gathered armloads of wood for the fire. In no time, a blazing fire was sending out comfort and warmth to the three young girls on the run from the policemen and trackers. Over sweet black tea and fruitcake, they chatted softly, recalling events of the past week, while all across the country news of the search for the three escapees spread. In the morning, Molly rose first and stepped out to study the sky. There were only a few scattered clouds about, no signs of rain. She lit the fire, and once the flames died down, put a tin of water on the hot coals for tea. The only sign of yesterday's rain was the water drops dripping from the leaves. Molly wished that she could sleep in a little longer like Gracie and Daisy, but it would be a long time before she could enjoy that pleasure. Gracie grumbled and refused to budge from the shelter. But the aroma of freshly made tea brought her over to the fire, and like Daisy, she waited patiently while Molly broke off equal portions of meat, bread, and cake. As soon as the girls finished eating, they cleaned away all evidence of ever being there.
"We still go Gagada,
east," Molly told them. "You better fill your tins with water now," she added. It wasn't long before they came upon another farmhouse. Daisy and Gracie had their routine down perfectly. They were fortunate that the farmers and their families in the northern wheat belt were generous to the Escapees. Their supply of food would sustain them for the next few days at least. With their strong legs and satisfied stomachs, they began to cut back their sleeping hours. That night, the runaways sat gazing at the campfire and watched the sparks rise. "At home, our mummies make really big fires. Not like here," said Gracie.
"Yes, I remember," Molly answered quietly.
Were they being followed? Were they safe? Molly could only wonder. The one thing that she was sure about was that they would return home to Jigalong. The only problem she had to worry about was finding the rabbit-proof fence. "We must come to it soon," she told herself as she went to wake the girls. The next day, instead of taking a shortcut through the wheat field, the girls walked along the firebreaks where the clear path enabled them to walk much faster. They passed by cattle and flocks of sheep, but had no time to stop and admire the snow-white lambs or the pretty wildflowers. They walked on through rugged, uncleared land over hills and across valleys, heading for the blue ranges in the distance. The warm sun on their backs felt good. The girls were glad to get rid of the wheat sack capes. Maybe too soon, Molly thought, noticing the build-up of rain clouds in the southwest. The sun was shining, the birds were singing, and there was plenty to eat. But the untreated scratches on their legs worried Molly. The girls didn't complain, but Molly noticed that the sores had begun to slow their progress. She led them to a dry creek bed. They each picked a sharp thorn from an acacia bush to burst the sores and release the pus. It hurt, but the Western Desert girls knew that infection might cripple them, and there was still a long way to walk. By now, every police station in the Wheatbelt District was on the alert for three Aboriginal girls who had escaped from the Moore River native settlement. The eldest was said to be wearing a large military overcoat, while the younger two had short military jackets. Anyone who came into contact with them was advised to capture and hold them until the authorities arrived. To confuse the searchers, the girls would pretend to leave a farmhouse in the opposite direction from which they had arrived. They would walk in a full circle, then, sure they weren't followed, they would double back and continue on their journey. By late afternoon, Molly, Gracie and Daisy were enjoying the warm, dry weather in countryside similar to their homeland. It no longer seemed like they had been on the run for weeks. They had left the red loam earth, the mallee gums and green fields, and were now entering the landscape of red soil, mulga trees and bright green kurrajong trees. The three girls felt at ease. They had come a long way since their escape. The green grass under the trees told them that they had good rain in this country. They knew that in a few weeks' time, the land would be covered with wild flowers of spring. Molly avoided the towns, and now the station homesteads too. It was too risky. She knew people living in these places were in constant contact with the police and the Native Affairs Department. As usual, Molly was walking ahead. Suddenly she crouched behind a mulga tree, picked up a small rock and threw it at Gracie's feet. Her cousin looked up and mouthed the word, "What?" Responding quickly to her hand language, Gracie and Daisy ran up and crouched beside her.
"Look, over there," Molly whispered, pointing to what looked like a station outcamp.
This was a temporary place where workers stayed during mustering time.
"Go and see if you can find some food."
Daisy and Gracie were used to such instructions. They had become a normal part of the journey. They would get the food while Molly hid, keeping watch. The two younger girls had no problem, especially when it came to providing something to eat. No sneaking around. The direct approach was the only way for them. Daisy peeped through a crack in the wooden door and saw the place was empty. There was no one inside. She called out to Gracie to come as she unbolted the door and stepped inside. The two girls began touching and picking up anything that might be useful. They found matches, salt, flour and tea. Gracie opened a heavy tin.
"Smell this, Daisy,"
she said, holding out the large tin. As the two took a big sniff, memories of station life, roast mutton and fried meat came flooding back. The starving girls dipped not just one hand but both into the tin and scooped up as much of the dripping as they could manage and gobbled it up.
"This tastes really good," Daisy said as she dipped her fingers in for more.
"Come on, we gotta hurry," Gracie said as she swept up their precious finds in her arms. Daisy spied a billy can and grabbed it as they ran to Molly's hiding place. But just as the pair reached the prickly Kurara bush, both stopped suddenly and began vomiting.
"You stupid beggars. You know you shouldn't eat gingy, dripping, by itself," Molly yelled.
They both had recovered by that night after they made camp and sat down to the kind of supper that reminded them of home. There was sweet black tea and hot damper made on a clean frock given to them by a farmer's wife. It was a simple meal and a change from wild bird eggs, rabbits and goannas. Chapter 12. The Rabbit-Proof Fence. With full bellies and a good sleep, it was easier to carry Daisy, whose infected sores had made walking too difficult. Molly was somewhere up ahead as Gracie walked behind with Daisy on her back. The pair were quietly enjoying the familiar sounds of a bush similar to home. The quiet was shattered by a piercing cry ahead. Gracie quickly unloaded Daisy and ran to her cousin's aid.
"What's wrong, Judo?"
she asked the usually quiet and controlled Molly.
"I found it!" Molly shouted. "I found the rabbit-proof fence!"
"How do you know it's the rabbit-proof fence?" Gracie couldn't see anything special about this one. It looked the same as any other.
"This fence is straight and has been cleared on each side, see?"
Molly would know. She had grown up near this fence, which stretches for 1,500 kilometres and was built to keep rabbits from crossing into the heartland of Western Australia. And too, her father was the rabbit-proof fence inspector.
"It's going to take us all the way home to Jigalong."
At that moment, a warm feeling of hope flowed through Molly's 14-year-old body. However, she also knew that finding that special fence did not mean that they were out of danger of being caught by all those who were chasing them now. News of more sightings of the runaways had spread through every district. Cheered by finding the rabbit-proof fence, Molly, Daisy and Gracie walked on happily. They entered a clearing surrounded by mulga trees and acacia bushes, and were excited to discover some freshly dug murundu holes. They began digging for the murundu, glad to again do what was their normal activity at this time of year in their own country. They were startled by a man's voice calling out,
"Hey, you girls, wait!"
They tossed the bush tucker to one side, leaving it where they had been digging as they dashed into the thick scrub to hide.
"Don't run, I only want to talk to you,"
the man called out in the direction of the scrub. Under the cover of the acacia bushes, peeping through the branches, the three girls saw that he was riding a pushbike and he looked Aboriginal like them. With one hand he steered the pushbike and in the other he held a small bag as he pedalled towards them with great difficulty.
"Look, I've got some food to give you, see? Come on, don't be frightened."
The stranger stopped near their hideaway, explaining that his name was Don and he was a Yamachi from Yalgu and he worked as a stockman on Pindathuna Station. Seeing the offer of food, the girls overcame their fear and stepped out from the bushes.
"Where are you girls going?"
the stockman asked while they shared his lunch of tinned meat and bread. "We're going to follow the railway line to Wiluna." Molly did the talking. As soon as they parted, the stockman returned to the station and reported that there was nothing wrong with the escapees. Days before, when he had come across their tracks, it had seemed like the footprints that there were only two girls walking through the station property. Now, after meeting them, he could see that they had bad sores on their legs, and he figured out that one girl was being carried. That was why one set of footprints was heavier. That night, the girls did without their comforting warm tin of tea. Molly said a fire would be too much to chance. They could not trust even the stockman whose food they sat and ate in the dark before crawling under the bushes to sleep. The next morning, Molly made a plan to outwit their would-be captors. She climbed over to the other side of the rabbit-proof fence and doubled back to pick up the bush tucker they had dropped when the stockman surprised them. Then they continued on their way to Jigalong. There was one thing they could be thankful for, and that was they were making a path through landscape that was the same as their own. In this country, they felt safe. According to the policemen, who were following closely behind Molly, Gracie and Daisy, the runaways were covering between an incredible 20 or 40 miles a day. They had been on the run for 5 weeks now, surviving on bush food and fresh water. That diet changed late one afternoon when the shadows were long. The girls entered a clearing near the rabbit-proof fence where they spied an emu and her 6 black and white striped chicks following noisily behind. Daisy was ordered to stay out of sight while Molly and Gracie gave chase. They caught one chick each. The old man emu was angry and pursued them. He stomped his strong feet on the ground, threatening to kick and claw them. He stopped when he realized that the other chicks were left unprotected. The girls hastily made a fire, and as it began to burn brightly, they hid behind the thick bushes and waited to see if anyone would come to investigate. They waited until it seemed safe enough to come out. They plucked the feathers off the chicks before cooking them in hot ashes. That night they enjoyed a meal of emu and damper washed down with a warm tin of bitter black tea. During the night, Molly had a nightmare, her first for many years. She dreamed a policeman and a tracker were running them down on horses. She could see them clearly riding beside the fence. A beautiful grey stallion and his rider were coming closer and closer, and at that critical moment she woke up shaking with fear and soaked in sweat. Then Molly heard clearly, clip, clop, clip, clop. She was awake. This was real. She reached out and shook the other two, whispering, "Keep still. Don't make a sound." The fugitives lay flat on their stomachs, not daring to move, wondering if it was the police or maybe the tracker. At last the sound of hoofs passed by. Molly crawled out from under the bushes to check. There was relief in her voice as she informed Gracie and Daisy. It was only station horses, not policemen. Chapter 13. The Railway Siding. Thoughts of home spurred them on as they drew closer to Jigalong, but moods changed when they reached a railway siding called Mount Russell, the place that would decide the fate of their cousin Gracie. Gracie decided to visit the Aboriginal people working near the siding. She had left Molly and Daisy hiding in the shade of the trees. When she returned, Gracie was full of excitement about news that her mother was in nearby Wiluna. "The train stopped here on the way to Wiluna," she said, and she planned to wait until it arrived. She would take the train home to her mother. Molly and Daisy looked on in shock as Gracie announced that she had had enough of trekking across strange country and always having to sleep under the bushes and not having enough to eat. Despite the pleading and begging not to split up when they had almost reached their destination, Gracie would not change her mind. Molly found Gracie's decision very hard to accept, but in the end, she agreed with her younger sister that it was closer to Wiluna than it was to Jigalong. They must finish the journey without her. By noon on the day they parted, it was the hottest temperature on record. Molly and Daisy continued north along the rabbit-proof fence towards home. They had not gone far when, filled with disappointment and a deep feeling of loss, Molly lay down on the first creek bed they came to. While she lay on the cool, soft sand, Daisy looked for food. Molly was thinking about the journey. It was good to be a long way from the town of Meekatharra, where the noise of everyday activities, like the shunting of the goods trains, was strange to these girls from the western desert. Gracie had tried to convince Molly to call in to see an old woman they knew there, but Molly warned her not to be so stupid. "There are policemen in that town looking for us. Come on." What Molly didn't know was that the Meekatharra police and an Aboriginal tracker who were following them by car were only 3 days away from them. They were driving over rough country in heavy rain, which made it impossible to continue on. So they made a camp and planned to try again in the morning. The next day, the policeman and his tracker had no success because all the footprints had been washed away by the heavy rain during the night. They returned to the police station. While Molly dozed, Daisy was gathering wood to make a fire when she heard a strange man's voice calling out to her. "Hello, where's your big sister?" Daisy looked up and saw a tall, slim Aboriginal stockman. She answered by throwing stones and swearing at him in Mardu Wonga. He ran off, weaving and ducking the stones. "I know who you are. I'm going to report you to the police. You wait." Molly, wakened by the shouting, asked what was going on. When Daisy explained, she was shaken by the stranger's threat to inform the police. But still hoping that their cousin would change her mind and return, the two girls lingered at the creek bed until late afternoon. That never happened. Filled with sadness, Molly and Daisy gathered up their bags and headed north. This time their steps were faster and stronger. Molly changed their sleeping pattern. Now they slept under the bushes during the heat of the day and set out in the late afternoon and walked through the night. Molly could feel it. They were almost home. It was still light as Molly and Daisy climbed through the southern boundary fence of Station 594 along the Canning Stock Route. The station was run by relations, the George family, Bob and Evie. Their aunt, Evie's mother, greeted them in the traditional manner by crying with them. They cried together too for those who had passed away since their last meeting. Everyone gathered around and told Molly and Daisy how happy they were to see them safe in their own country and back with their own people. Before they sat down to a most welcome meal of beef stew, homemade bread and a mug of sweet milky tea, Molly and Daisy sank into a tub of warm, soapy water, which was nice and clear before they got into the bath. But when they were finished, the water looked like an ochre-coloured pool. That night, after weeks as fugitives of the West Australian government, they were able to sleep in a bed. They didn't wake until their aunt called them for breakfast. After a big, hearty breakfast, they joined Ron Clarkson, the contract worker on the rabbit-proof fence, and his co-worker, their cousin Billy, as they prepared to return to the Jigalong depot.
You girls can take it in turns in riding on the camel all the way to Jigalong,
Mr. Clarkson told them. Molly took the first few miles, then changed places with Daisy. The view from high up on the camel was so beautiful. They looked out on the Spinifex and Gibber Plains and the large salt lakes and knew that they were close to home. Molly and Daisy called out to each other excitedly, pointing to sights and places with very special meanings to them. Just a few miles to go now, Chapter 14. Boy on the Hill. The girls' mothers were living in a secret camp not far from Jigalong Depot. Beside it, on the highest hill, sat 8-year-old Billy. He kept his sharp eyes focused on the rabbit-proof fence, watching and waiting for the first glimpse of Molly and Daisy. He had been sitting on the hill for hours, ever since the rider came into camp early that morning with the happy news that Molly and Daisy were safe and on the way home. Billy had grabbed a crust of damper and raced out of the camp and climbed the hill. He wanted to be the first to spot the famous Jigalong girls as they finished their walk across hundreds of kilometres of strange country. Nothing yet. His silent hand signals kept repeating to the anxious relations keeping watch from the camp. Then, at last, his eyes could just make out a rider coming towards him along the straight line of rabbit-proof fence. Billy stood up, and as the shape drew closer, he could make out Ron Clarkson on horseback. And behind him was Daisy on a camel. Molly was walking beside her. Trying hard not to shout and alert the police at the depot, Billy jumped up and down, waving his arms from side to side. He turned to the camp and pointed frantically in the direction of the rabbit-proof fence before dashing down the hill to meet the runaways. As soon as he arrived, shrill questions filled the air. He danced around his cousins, chattering away, asking them one question after the other.
Where's Gracie? How did you get Mirka?
Food.
Where did you find Galyu?
Water.
Can I have a ride?
Billy spoke so fast he left no time for answers. Molly could only laugh and say,
Later, later.
The contract worker waved goodbye and led the camel towards the depot. Molly and Daisy walked behind Billy, who skipped ahead to the camp. As they neared the creek, the girls pulled up suddenly. They could hear the voices from the camp speaking Mardu-Wunga. They were suddenly overcome with emotions. They had come home to their mothers, their family and their homeland. The warm, red earth, the Spinifex grass and the winter murra trees. Around the campfire that night, the girls sat with their families and talked about tomorrow's plans. They will be moved to a camp where they would be safe. But for now, this is what Molly and Daisy wanted, sleeping beside their mothers near a big, warm fire. Now they knew they were home at last. That is the end of Home to Mother by Doris Pilkington Garimurra, narrated by Rachel Mazza. This sound recording was produced by Louis Braille Audio in 2006.